Now, the last change, said Human. The wives meant this to punish you for making this covenant so difficult, but I think you will believe it is no punishment, since we are forbidden to take you into the third life. After this covenant is in effect, humans are also forbidden to take brothers into the third life. For a moment, Ender thought it meant his reprieve. He would not have to do the thing that Lebo and Pipo had both refused. After the covenant, said Human, you will be the first and last human to give this gift.
I wish, said Ender.
I know what you wish, my friend speaker, said Human. To you it feels like murder, but to me, when a brother is given the right to pass into the third life as a father, then he chooses his greatest rival or his truest friend to give him the passage, you. Speaker, ever since I first learned Stark and read the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, I waited for you. I said many times to my father, Rooter, of all humans, he is the one who will understand us. Then Rooter told me, when your starship came, that it was you and the Hive Queen aboard that ship, and I knew then that you had come to give me passage, if only I did well.
You did well, human, said Ender.
Here, he said, see? We signed the covenant in the human way.
At the bottom of the last page of the covenant, two words were crudely, elaborately shaped. Human, Ender read aloud. The other word he could not read.
It's Shouter's true name, said Human. Starlooker. She wasn't good with the writing stick. The wives don't use tools very often, since the brothers do that kind of work. So she wanted me to tell you what her name is, and to tell you that she got it because she was always looking in the sky. She says that she didn't know it then, but she was watching for you to come.
So many people had so much hope in me, thought Ender. In the end, though, everything depended on them. On Novinia, Miro, Ella, who called for me, on Human and Starlooker, and on the ones who feared my coming, too. Worm carried the cup of ink. Calendar carried the pen. It was a thin strip of wood with a slit in it and a narrow well that held a little ink when he dipped it in the cup. He had to dip it 5 times in order to sign his name.
5, said Arrow.
Ender remembered then that the number 5 was portentous to the piggies. It had been an accident, but if they chose to see it as a good omen, so much the better. I'll take the covenant to our governor and the bishop, said Ender.
Of all the documents that were ever treasured in the history of mankind, said Wanda.
No one needed her to finish the sentence. Human, Leaf Eater, and Mandachuva carefully wrapped the book again in leaves and handed it, not to Ender, but to Wanda. Ender knew at once, with terrible certainty, what that meant. The piggies still had work for him to do, work that would require that his hands be free.
Now the covenant is made the human way, said Human. You must make it true for the little ones as well.
Can't the signing be enough? Asked Ender.
From now on the signing is enough, said Human, but only because the same hand that signed for the humans also took the covenant in our way too.
Then I will, said Ender. As I promised you I would. Human reached out and stroked Ender from the throat to the belly.
The brother's word is not just in his mouth, he said. The brother's word is in his life.
He turned to the other piggies.
Let me speak to my father one last time before I stand beside him.
Two of the strange brothers came forward with their small clubs in their hands. They walked with Human to Rooter's tree and began to beat on it and sing in the tree language. Almost at once the trunk split open. The tree was still fairly young, not so very much thicker in the trunk than Human's own body. It was a struggle for him to get inside, but he fit, and the trunk closed up after him. The drumming changed rhythm, but did not let up for a moment. Jane whispered in Ender's ear.
I can hear the resonance of the drumming change inside the tree, she said. The tree is slowly shaping the sound to turn the drumming into language.
The other piggies set to work clearing ground for Human's tree. Ender noticed that he would be planted so that from the gate, Rooter would seem to stand on the left hand and Human on the right. Pulling up the capim by the root was hard work for the piggies. Soon King was helping them, and then Olhado, and then Wanda and Ella. Wanda gave the covenant to Novinia to hold while she helped dig capim. Novenia, in turn, carried it to Ender, stood before him, looked at him steadily.
"You signed it Ender Wiggin," she said. "Ender."
The name sounded ugly even to his own ears. He had heard it too often as an epithet. "I'm older than I look," said Ender. "That was the name I was known by when I blasted the bugger's home world out of existence. Maybe the presence of that name on the first treaty ever signed between humans and Raman will do something to change the meaning of the name."
"Ender," she whispered.
She reached toward him, the bundled treaty in her hands, and held it against his chest. It was heavy, since it contained all the pages of the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, on the other sides of pages where the covenant was written.
"I never went to the priests to confess," she said, "because I knew they would despise me for my sin. Yet when you named all my sins today, I could bear it because I knew you didn't despise me. I couldn't understand why, though, till now."
"I'm not one to despise other people for their sins," said Ender. "I haven't found one yet that I didn't say inside myself I've done worse than this."
"All these years you've borne the burden of humanity's guilt."
"Yes, well, it's nothing mystical," said Ender. "I think of it as being like the mark of Cain. You don't make many friends, but nobody hurts you much either." The ground was clear. Mandachuva spoke in tree language to the piggies beating on the trunk. Their rhythm changed, and again the aperture in the tree came open. Human slid out as if he were an infant being born. Then he walked to the center of the cleared ground. Leaf Eater and Mandachuva each handed him a knife. As he took the knives, Human spoke to them in Portuguese, so the humans could understand, and so it would carry great force.
"I told Shouter that you lost your passage to the third life because of a great misunderstanding by Pipo and Libo.
She said that before another hand of hands of days, you both would grow upward into the light." Leaf Eater and Mandachuva both let go of their knives, touched Human gently on the belly, and stepped back to the edge of the cleared ground. Human held out the knives to Ender. They were both made of thin wood. Ender could not imagine a tool that could polish wood to be at once so fine and sharp, and yet so strong. But of course no tool had polished these. They had come thus perfectly shaped from the heart of a living tree, given as a gift to help a brother into the third life. It was one thing to know with his mind that Human would not really die. It was another thing to believe it. Ender did not take the knives at first. Instead, he reached past the blades and took Human by the wrists.
"To you, it doesn't feel like death, but to me,
I only saw you for the first time yesterday, and tonight I know you are my brother as surely as if Ruter were my father, too. And yet, when the sun rises in the morning, I'll never be able to talk to you again. It feels like death to me, Human, however it feels to you."
"Come and sit in my shade," said Human, "and see the sunlight through my leaves, and rest your back against my trunk. And do this also. Add another story to the Hive Queen and the Hegemon. Call it The Life of Human. Tell all the humans how I was conceived on the bark of my father's tree, and born in darkness, eating my mother's flesh. Tell them how I left the life of darkness behind, and came into the half-light of my second life to learn language from the wives, and then come forth to learn all the miracles that Libo and Miro and Wanda came to teach. Tell them how on the last day of my second life my true brother came from above the sky, and together we made this covenant so that humans and piggies would be one tribe. Not a human tribe or a piggy tribe, but a tribe of Raman. And then my friend gave me passage to the third life, to the full light, so that I could rise into the sky and give life to 10,000 children before I die."
"I'll tell your story," said Ender.
"Then I will truly live forever."
Ender took the knives. Human lay down upon the ground.
"Oyado," said Novenia. "Kim, go back to the gate. Ella, you too." "I'm going to see this, mother," said Ella. "I'm a scientist."
"You forget my eyes," said Oyado. "I'm recording everything. We can show humans everywhere that the treaty was signed, and we can show piggies that the speaker took the covenant in their way, too.
I'm not going either, said King. Even the Blessed Virgin stood at the foot of the cross.
So stay, said Novena softly. And she also stayed. Human's mouth was filled with capim, but he didn't chew it very much.
More, said Ender, so you don't feel anything.
That's not right, said Mandachuva.
These are the last moments of his second life. It's good to feel something of the pains of this body, to remember when you're in the third life and beyond pain.
Mandachuva and Leaf Eater told Ender where and how to cut. It had to be done quickly, they told him, and their hands reached into the steaming body to point out organs that must go here or there. Ender's hands were quick and sure, his body calm. But even though he could only rarely spare a glance away from the surgery, he knew that above his bloody work, human's eyes were watching him. Watching him filled with gratitude and love, filled with agony and death. It happened under his hands, so quickly that for the first few minutes they could watch it grow. Several large organs shriveled as roots shot out of them. Tendrils reached from place to place within the body. Human's eyes went wide with the final agony, and out of his spine a sprout burst upward. 2 leaves, 4 leaves, and then stopped. The body was dead. Its last spasm of strength had gone to making the tree that rooted in human's spine. Ender had seen the rootlets and tendrils reaching through the body. The memories, the soul of human, had been transferred into the cells of the newly sprouted tree. It was done. His third life had begun. And when the sun rose in the morning, not long from now, the leaves would taste the light for the first time. The other piggies were rejoicing, dancing. Leaf Eater and Mandachuva took the knives from Ender's hands and jammed them into the ground on either side of human's head. Ender could not join their celebration. He was covered with blood and reeked with the stench of the body he had butchered. On all fours, he crawled from the body up the hill to a place where he didn't have to see it. Novena followed him. Exhausted, spent, all of them, from the work and the emotions of the day. They said nothing, did nothing, but fell into the thick capim, each one leaning or lying on someone else, seeking relief at last in sleep, as the piggies danced away up the hill into the woods.
Boschina and Bishop Peregrino made their way to the gate before the sun was up, to watch for the speaker's return from the forest. They were there a full 10 minutes before they saw a movement much nearer than the forest's edge. It was a boy, sleepily voiding his bladder into a bush. Olhado, called the mayor. The boy turned, waved, then hastily fastened his trousers and began waking others who slept in the tall grass. Boschina and the bishop opened the gate and walked out to meet them. Foolish, isn't it? Said Boschina. But this is the moment when our rebellion seems most real, when I first walk beyond the fence. Why did they spend the night out of doors? Peregrino wondered aloud. The gate was open. They could have gone home. Boschina took a quick census of the group outside the gates. Wanda and Ella, arm in arm like sisters. Olhado and King, Novena. And there, yes, the speaker, sitting down, Novena behind him, resting her hands on his shoulders. They all waited expectantly, saying nothing, until Ender looked up at them. We have the treaty, he said. It's a good one. Novena held up a bundle wrapped in leaves. They wrote it down, she said, for you to sign. Boschina took the bundle. All the files were restored before midnight, she said. Not just the ones we saved in your message queue. Whoever your friend is, Speaker, he's very good. She, said the Speaker, her name is Jane. Now, though, the bishop and Boschina could see what lay on the clear earth, just down the hill from where the speaker had slept. Now they understood the dark stains on the speaker's hands and arms, the spatter marks on his face. I would rather have no treaty, said Boschina, than one you had to kill to get. Wait before you judge, said the bishop. I think the knight's work was more than just what we see before us. Very wise, Father Peregrino, said the speaker softly. I'll explain it to you if you want, said Wanda. Ella and I understand it as well as anyone. It was like a sacrament, said Oliado. Boschina looked at Novinia, uncomprehending. You let him watch? Oliado tapped his eyes. All the piggies will see it some day through my eyes. It wasn't death, said King. It was resurrection. The bishop stepped near the tortured corpse and touched the seedling tree growing from the chest cavity. His name is Human, said the speaker. And so is yours, said the bishop softly. He turned and looked around at the members of his little flock, who had already taken humanity a step further than it had ever gone before.
Am I the shepherd? Peregrino asked himself, or the most confused and helpless of the sheep. Come, all of you, come with me to the cathedral. The bells will soon ring for Mass. The children gathered and prepared to go. Novinia, too, stepped away from her place behind the speaker. Then she stopped, turned back to him, looked at him with silent invitation in her eyes. Soon, he said, a moment more. She, too, followed the bishop through the gate and up the hill into the cathedral. The Mass had barely begun when Peregrino saw the speaker enter at the back of the cathedral. He paused a moment, then found Novinia and her family with his eyes. In only a few steps he had taken a place beside her, where McCown had sat, those rare times when the whole family came together. The duties of the service took his attention. A few moments later, when Peregrino could look again, he saw that Gregor was now sitting beside the speaker. Peregrino thought of the terms of the treaty as the girls had explained it to him, of the meaning of the death of the piggy called Human, and before him, of the deaths of Pippo and Libo. All things coming clear, all things coming together. The young man, Miro, lying paralyzed in bed with his sister, Wanda, tending him. Novinia, the lost one, now found. The fence, its shadow so dark in the minds of all who had lived within its bounds, now still and harmless, invisible, insubstantial. It was the miracle of the wafer, turned into the flesh of God in his hands. How suddenly we find the flesh of God within us after all, when we thought that we were only made of dust.
Chapter 18. The Hive Queen. Evolution gave his mother no birth canal and no breasts, so the small creature who would one day be named Human was given no exit from the womb except by the teeth of his mouth. He and his infant siblings devoured their mother's body. Because Human was strongest and most vigorous, he ate the most and so became even stronger. Human lived in utter darkness. When his mother was gone, there was nothing to eat but the sweet liquid that flowed on the surface of his world. He did not know yet that the vertical surface was the inside of a great hollow tree, and that the liquid that he ate was the sap of the tree. Nor did he know that the warm creatures that were far larger than himself were older pequeninos, almost ready to leave the darkness of the tree, and that the smaller creatures were younger ones, more recently emerged than himself. All he really cared about was to eat, to move, and to see the light. For now and then, in rhythms that he could not comprehend, a sudden light came into the darkness. It began each time with a sound whose source he could not comprehend. Then the tree would shudder slightly, the sap would cease to flow, and all the tree's energy would be devoted to changing the shape of the trunk in one place, to make an opening that let the light inside. When the light was there, human moved toward it. When the light was gone, human lost his sense of direction and wandered aimlessly in search of liquid to drink. Until one day, when almost all the other creatures were smaller than himself, and none at all were larger, the light came, and he was so strong and swift that he reached the opening before it closed. He bent his body around the curve of the wood of the tree, and for the first time felt the rasp of outer bark under his soft belly. He hardly noticed this new pain because the light dazzled him. It was not just in one place, but everywhere. And it was not gray, but vivid green and yellow. His rapture lasted many seconds. Then he was hungry again. And here on the outside of the mother tree, the sap flowed only in the fissures of the bark, where it was hard to reach. And instead of all the other creatures being little ones that he could push aside, they all were larger than himself, and drove him away from the easy feeding places. This was a new thing, a new world, a new life, and he was afraid. Later, when he learned language, he would remember the journey from darkness into light, and he would call it the passage from the first life to the second, from the life of darkness to the half-lit life. Speaker for the Dead, The Life of Human, Chapter 1, Verses 1 through 5.
Miro decided to leave Lusitania, take the Speaker's starship, and go to Trondheim after all. Perhaps at his trial he could persuade the Hundred Worlds not to go to war against Lusitania. At worst, he could become a martyr, to stir people's hearts, to be remembered, to stand for something. Whatever happened to him, it would be better than staying here. In the first few days after he climbed the fence, Miro recovered rapidly. He gained some control and feeling in his arms and legs, enough to take shuffling steps like an old man, enough to move his arms and hands, enough to end the humiliation of his mother having to clean his body. But then his progress slowed and stopped. "Here it is," said Navio. "We have reached the level of permanent damage. You are so lucky, Miro. You can walk, you can talk, you are a whole man. You are no more limited than, say, a very healthy man who is 100 years old. I would rather tell you that your body would be as it was before you climbed the fence, that you would have all the vigor and control of a 20-year-old, but I'm very glad that I don't have to tell you that you will be bedridden all your life, diapered and catheterized, able to do nothing more than listen to soft music and wonder where your body went." "So I'm grateful," Miro thought, "as my fingers curl into a useless club on the ends of my arms, as I hear my own speech sounding thick and unintelligible, my voice unable to modulate properly. Then I will be glad that I am like 100-year-old man, that I can look forward to 80 more years of life as a centenarian." Once it was clear that he did not need constant attention, the family scattered and went about their business. These days were too exciting for them to stay home with a crippled brother, son, friend. He understood completely. He did not want them to stay home with him. He wanted to be with them. His work was unfinished. Now, at long last, all the fences, all the rules were gone. Now he could ask the piggies the questions that had so long puzzled him. He tried at first to work through Wanda. She came to him every morning and evening and made her reports on the terminal in the front room of the Hibera house. He read her reports, asked her questions, listened to her stories, and she very seriously memorized the questions he wanted her to ask the piggies. After a few days of this, however, he noticed that in the evening she would indeed have the answers to Miro's questions, but there was no follow-up, no exploration of meaning. Her real attention was devoted to her own work, and Miro stopped giving her questions to ask for him. He lied and told her that he was far more interested in what she was doing, that her avenues of exploration were the most important. The truth was that he hated seeing Wanda. For him, the revelation that she was his sister was painful, terrible, but he knew that if the decision were his alone, he would cast aside the incest taboo, marry her, and live in the forest with the piggies if need be. Wanda, however, was a believer, a belonger. She couldn't possibly violate the only universal human law. She grieved when she learned that Mito was her brother, but she immediately began to separate herself from him, to forget the touches, the kisses, the whispers, the promises, the teasing, the laughter. Better if he forgot them too, but he could not. Every time he saw her, it hurt him to see how reserved she was, how polite and kind she was. He was her brother. He was crippled. She would be good to him. But the love was gone. Uncharitably, he compared Wanda to his own mother, who had loved her lover regardless of the barriers between them. But mother's lover had been a whole man, an able man, not this useless carcass. So Mito stayed home and studied the file reports of everybody else's work. It was torture to know what they were doing, that he could not take part in it. But it was better than doing nothing, or watching the tedious vids on the terminal, or listening to music. He could type, slowly, by aiming his hand so the stiffest of his fingers, the index finger, touched exactly one key. It wasn't fast enough to enter any meaningful data, or even to write memos. But he could call up other people's public files and read what they were doing. He could maintain some connection with the vital work that had suddenly blossomed on Lusitania with the opening of the gate. Wanda was working with the piggies on a lexicon of the males' and wives' languages, complete with a phonetic spelling system so they could write their language down. Keem was helping her, but Mito knew that he had his own purpose. He intended to be a missionary to the Pequeninos in other tribes, taking them the Gospels before they ever saw the Hive Queen and the Hegemon. He intended to translate at least some of the scripture and speak to the piggies in their own language. All this work with piggy language and culture was very good, very important, preserve the past, prepare to communicate with other tribes, but Mito knew that it could easily be done by Don Cristão's scholars, who now ventured forth in their monkish robes and quietly asked questions of the piggies and answered their questions ably and powerfully. Wanda was allowing herself to become redundant, Mito believed. The real work with the piggies, as Mito saw it, was being done by Ender and a few key technicians from Bosquinha's services department. They were laying pipe from the river to the mother tree's clearing to bring water to them. They were setting up electricity and teaching the brothers how to use a computer terminal. In the meantime, they were teaching them very primitive means of agriculture and trying to domesticate cabras to pull plows. It was confusing, the different levels of technology that were coming to the piggies all at once. But Ender had discussed it with Mito, explaining that he wanted the piggies to see quick, dramatic, immediate results from their treaty. Running water, a computer connection with a holographic terminal that let them read anything in the library, electric lights at night. But all this was still magic, completely dependent on human society. At the same time, Ender was trying to keep them self-sufficient, inventive, resourceful. The dazzle of electricity would make myths that would spread through the world from tribe to tribe, but it would be no more than rumor for many, many years. It was the wooden plow, the scythe, the harrow, the amaranth seed that would make the real changes, that would allow piggy population to increase tenfold wherever they went. And those could be transmitted from place to place with a handful of seeds in a cobra-skin pouch and the memory of how the work was done. This was the work that Mito longed to be part of. But what good were his clubbed hands and shuffling step in the amaranth fields? Of what use was he sitting at a loom weaving cobra wool? He couldn't even talk well enough to teach. Ella was working on developing new strains of earthborn plants, and even small animals and insects, new species that could resist the descolada, even neutralize it. Mother was helping her with advice, but little more, for she was working on the most vital and secret project of them all. Again, it was Ender who came to Mito and told him what only his family and Wanda knew, that the Hive Queen lived, that she was being restored. As soon as Novenia found a way for her to resist the Descolada, her and all the buggers that would be born to her, as soon as it was ready, the Hive Queen would be revived. And Mito would not be part of that either. For the first time, humans and two alien races living together as Raman on the same world. And Mito wasn't part of any of it. He was less human than the piggies were. He couldn't speak or use his hands half so well. He had stopped being a tool-using, language-speaking animal. He was Varelse now. They only kept him as a pet. He wanted to go away. Better yet, he wanted to disappear, to go away even from himself. But not right now. There was a new puzzle that only he knew about, and so only he could solve. His terminal was behaving very strangely. He noticed it the first week after he recovered from total paralysis. He was scanning some of Wanda's files and realized that without doing anything special, he had accessed confidential files. They were protected with several layers. He had no idea what the passwords were, and yet a simple routine scan had brought the information forward. It was her speculations on Pequenino evolution and their probable pre-Descolada society and life patterns. The sort of thing that as recently as 2 weeks ago she would have talked about, argued about with Miro. Now she kept it confidential and never discussed it with him at all. Miro didn't tell her he had seen the files, but he did steer conversations toward the subject and drew her out. She talked about her ideas willingly enough once Miro showed his interest. Sometimes it was almost like old times, except that he would hear the sound of his own slurred voice and keep most of his opinions to himself, merely listening to her, letting things he would have argued with pass right by. Still, seeing her confidential files allowed him to penetrate to what she was really interested in. But how had he seen them? It happened again and again, files of Ella's, mother's, Don Cristal's. As the piggies began to play with their new terminal, Miro was able to watch them in an echo mode that he had never seen the terminal use before. It enabled him to watch all their computer transactions and then make some suggestions, change things a little. He took particular delight in guessing what the piggies were really trying to do and helping them surreptitiously to do it. But how had he got such unorthodox, powerful access to the machine? The terminal was learning to accommodate itself to him, too. Instead of long code sequences, he only had to begin a sequence, and the machine would obey his instructions. Finally, he did not even have to log on. He touched the keyboard, and the terminal displayed a list of all the activities he usually engaged in, then scanned through them. He could touch a key, and it would go directly to the activity he wanted, skipping dozens of preliminaries, saving him many painful minutes of typing one character at a time. At first he thought that Oliado had created a new program for him, or perhaps someone in the mayor's office. But Oliado only looked blankly at what the terminal was doing and said, "Bacana, that's great." And when he sent a message to the mayor, she never got it. Instead, the speaker for the dead came to visit him. "So your terminal is being helpful," said Ender. Miro didn't answer. He was too busy trying to think why the mayor had sent the speaker to answer his note. "The mayor didn't get your message," said Ender. "I did. And it's better if you don't mention to anybody else what your terminal is doing." "Why?" asked Miro. That was one word he could say without slurring too much. "Because it isn't a new program helping you. It's a person." Miro laughed. No human being could be as quick as the program that was helping him. It was faster, in fact, than most programs he had worked with before, and very resourceful and intuitive. Faster than a human, but smarter than a program. "It's an old friend of mine, I think. At least she was the one who told me about your message and suggested that I let you know that discretion was a good idea. You see, she's a bit shy. She doesn't make many friends." "How many?" "At the present moment, exactly two. For a few thousand years before now, exactly one." "Not human," said Miro. "Raman," said Ender. "More human than most humans. We've loved each other for a long time, helped each other, depended on each other. But in the last few weeks, since I got here, we've drifted apart. I'm involved more in the lives of people around me. Your family." "Mother." "Yes, your mother, your brothers and sisters, the work with the piggies, the work for the Hive Queen. My friend and I used to talk to each other constantly. I don't have time now. We've hurt each other's feelings sometimes. She's lonely, and so I think she's chosen another companion." "No quiero." "Don't want one." "Yes, you do," said Ender. "She's already helped you. Now that you know she exists, you'll find that she's a good friend. You can't have a better one." More loyal, more helpful. Puppy dog, don't be a jackass, said Ender. I'm introducing you to a fourth alien species. You're supposed to be a xenologer, aren't you? She knows you, Miro. Your physical problems are nothing to her. She has no body at all. She exists among the philotic disturbances and the ansible communications of the hundred worlds. She's the most intelligent creature alive, and you're the second human being she's ever chosen to reveal herself to. How? How did she come to be? How did she know me, to choose me? Ask her yourself. Ender touched the jewel in his ear. Just a word of advice. Once she comes to trust you, keep her with you always. Keep no secrets from her. She once had a lover who switched her off. Only for an hour, but things were never the same between them after that. They became just friends. Good friends. Loyal friends. Always until he dies. But all his life he will regret that one thoughtless act of disloyalty. Ender's eyes glistened, and Miro realized that whatever this creature was that lived in the computer, it was no phantom. It was part of this man's life, and he was passing it down to Miro, like father to son, the right to know this friend. Ender left without another word, and Miro turned to the terminal. There was a hollow of a woman there. She was small, sitting on a stool, leaning against a holographic wall. She was not beautiful, not ugly either. Her face had character. Her eyes were haunting, innocent, sad. Her mouth delicate, about to smile, about to weep. Her clothing seemed veil-like, insubstantial, and yet instead of being provocative, it revealed a sort of innocence. A girlish, small-breasted body, the hands clasped lightly in her lap, her legs childishly parted with the toes pointing inward. She could have been sitting on a teeter-totter in a playground, or on the edge of her lover's bed. Bonjour, Miro said softly. Hi, she said. I asked him to introduce us. She was quiet, reserved, but it was Miro who felt shy. For so long, Wanda had been the only woman in his life, besides the women of his family, and he had little confidence in the social graces. At the same time, he was aware that he was speaking to a hologram, a completely convincing one, but a mid-air laser projection all the same. She reached up one hand and laid it gently on her breast. "Feels nothing," she said. "No nerves." Tears came to his eyes. Self-pity, of course, that he would probably never have a woman more substantial than this one. If he tried to touch one, his caresses would be crude pawing. Sometimes when he wasn't careful, he drooled and couldn't even feel it. What a lover. "But I have eyes," she said, "and ears. I see everything in all the hundred worlds. I watch the sky through a thousand telescopes. I overhear a trillion conversations every day." She giggled a little. "I'm the best gossip in the universe." Then suddenly she stood up, grew larger, closer, so that she only showed from the waist up, as if she had moved closer to an invisible camera. Her eyes burned with intensity as she stared right at him. "And you're a parochial schoolboy who's never seen anything but one town and one forest in his life." "Don't get much chance to travel," he said. "We'll see about that," she answered. "So, what do you want to do today?" "What's your name?" he asked. "You don't need my name," she said. "How do I call you?" "I'm here whenever you want me. But I want to know," he said. She touched her ear. "When you like me well enough to take me with you wherever you go, then I'll tell you my name." Impulsively, he told her what he had told no one else. "I want to leave this place," said Miro. "Can you take me away from Lusitania?" She at once became coquettish, mocking. "And we only just met. Really, Mr. Hibera, I'm not that sort of girl." "Maybe when we get to know each other," Miro said, laughing. She made a subtle, wonderful transition, and the woman on the screen was a lanky feline, sprawling sensuously on a tree limb. She purred noisily, stretched out a limb, groomed herself. "I can break your neck with a single blow from my paw," she whispered. Her tone of voice suggested seduction. Her claws promised murder. When I get you alone, I can bite your throat out with a single kiss. He laughed. Then he realized that in all this conversation, he had actually forgotten how slurred his speech was. She understood every word. She never said, "What? I didn't get that," or any of the other polite but infuriating things that people said. She understood him without any special effort at all. "I want to understand everything," said Miro. "I want to know everything and put it all together to see what it means." "Excellent project," she said. "It will look very good on your resume."
Ender found that Olhado was a much better driver than he was. The boy's depth perception was better, and when he plugged his eye directly into the onboard computer, navigation practically took care of itself. Ender could devote his energies to looking. The scenery seemed monotonous when they first began these exploratory flights. Endless prairies, huge herds of cabra, occasional forests in the distance. They never came close to those, of course, since they didn't want to attract the attention of the piggies that lived there. Besides, they were looking for a home for the Hive Queen, and it wouldn't do to put her too close to any tribe. Today they headed west, on the other side of Reuter's Forest, and they followed a small river to its outlet. They stopped there on the beach, with breakers rolling gently to shore. Ender tasted the water. Salt. The sea. Olhado got the onboard terminal to display a map of this region of Lusitania, pointing out their location, Reuter's Forest, and the other piggy settlements nearby. It was a good place, and in the back of his mind, Ender could sense the Hive Queen's approval. Near the sea, plenty of water, sunny. They skimmed over the water, traveling upstream a few hundred meters until the right bank rose to form a low cliff. "Any place to stop along here?" asked Ender. Olhado found a place 50 meters from the crown of the hill. They walked back along the river's edge, where the reeds gave way to the grama. Every river on Lusitania looked like this, of course. Ella had easily documented the genetic patterns as soon as she had access to Novenia's files and permission to pursue the subject. Reeds that co-reproduced with suckflies, grama that mated with water snakes, and then the endless capim, which rubbed its pollen-rich tassels on the bellies of fertile cabra to germinate the next generation of manure-producing animals. Entwined in the roots and stems of the capim were the tropecos, long-trailing vines that Ella proved had the same genes as the shingadora, the ground-nesting bird that used the living plant for its nest. The same sort of pairing continued in the forest. Masio worms that hatched from the seeds of Merdona vines and then gave birth to Merdona seed. Puladors, small insects that mated with the shiny-leafed bushes in the forest. And above all, the piggies and the trees, both at the peak of their kingdoms, plant and animal, merged into one long life. That was the list, the whole list of surface animals and plants of Lusitania. Underwater, there were many, many more, but the Descolada had left Lusitania monotonous. And yet, even the monotony had a peculiar beauty. The geography was as varied as any other world. Rivers, hills, mountains, deserts, oceans, islands. The carpet of capim and the patches of forest became background music to the symphony of landforms. The eye became sensitized to undulations, outcroppings, cliffs, pits, and above all, the sparkle and rush of water in the sunlight. Lusitania, like Trondheim, was one of the rare worlds that was dominated by a single motif instead of displaying the whole symphony of possibility. With Trondheim, however, it was because the planet was on the bare edge of habitability, its climate only just able to support surface life. Lusitania's climate and soil cried out a welcome to the oncoming plow, the excavator's pick, the mason's trowel. "Bring me to life," it said. Ender did not understand that he loved this place because it was as devastated and barren as his own life, stripped and distorted in his childhood by events every bit as terrible on a small scale as the Descolada had been to this world. And yet it had thrived, had found a few threads strong enough to survive and continue to grow. Out of the challenge of the Descolada had come the three lives of the little ones. Out of the battle school, out of years of isolation, had come Ender Wiggin. He fit this place as if he had planned it. The boy who walked beside him through the Grama felt like his true son, as if he had known the boy from infancy. I know how it feels to have a metal wall between me and the world, Olyado. But here and now I have made the wall come down, and flesh touches earth, drinks water, gives comfort, takes love. The earthen bank of the river rose in terraces, a dozen meters from shore to crest. The soil was moist enough to dig and hold its shape. The hive queen was a burrower. Ender felt the desire in him to dig, and so he dug, Olyado beside him. The ground gave way easily enough, and yet the roof of their cavelet stayed firm.
Yes, here.
And so it was decided. Here it is, said Ender aloud. Olyado grinned, but it was really Jane that Ender was talking to, and her answer that he heard. Novenia thinks they have it. The tests all came through negative. The Descolada stayed inactive with the new Collador present in the cloned bugger cells. Ella thinks that the daisies she's been working with can be adapted to produce the Collador naturally. If that works, you'll only have to plant seeds here and there, and the buggers can keep the Descolada at bay by sucking flowers. Her tone was lively enough, but it was all business, no fun. No fun at all. Fine, Ender said. He felt a stab of jealousy. Jane was no doubt talking far more easily with Miro, teasing him, taunting him, as she used to do with Ender. But it was easy enough to drive the feeling of jealousy away. He put out a hand and rested it easily on Olyado's shoulder. He momentarily pulled the boy close, and then together they walked back to the waiting flyer. Olyado marked the spot on the map and stored it. He laughed and made jokes all the way home, and Ender laughed with him. The boy wasn't Jane, but he was Olyado, and Ender loved him. And Olyado needed Ender, and that was what a few million years of evolution had decided Ender needed most. It was the hunger that had gnawed at him through all those years with Valentine, that had kept him moving from world to world, this boy with metal eyes, his bright and devastatingly destructive little brother, Grego, Kara's penetrating understanding, her innocence, King's utter self-control, asceticism, faith, Ella's dependability, like a rock. And yet she knew when to move out and act. And Miro. I have no consolation for Miro, not in this world, not at this time. His life's work was taken from him, his body, his hope for the future, and nothing I can say or do will give him a vital work to do. He lives in pain, his lover turned into his sister, his life among the piggies now impossible to him as they look to other humans for friendship and learning. Miro needs, Ender said softly. Miro needs to leave Lusitania, said Olyado. Said Ender. You've got a starship, haven't you? Said Olyado. I remember reading a story once, or maybe it was a vid, about an old-time hero in the Bugger Wars, Mazer Rackham. He saved Earth from destruction once, but they knew he'd be dead long before the next battle, so they sent him out in a starship at relativistic speeds, just sent him out and had him come back. 100 years had gone by for the Earth, but only 2 years for him. You think Miro needs something as drastic as that? There's a battle coming. There are decisions to make. Miro's the smartest person in Lusitania, and the best. He doesn't get mad, you know. Even in the worst of times with Father, Marcaun. Sorry. I still call him Father. That's all right. In many ways he was. Miro would think, and he'd decide the best thing to do, and it always was the best thing. Mother depended on him, too. The way I see it, we need Miro when Starways Congress sends its fleet against us. He'll study all the information, everything we've learned in the years that he was gone, put it all together, and tell us what to do. Ender couldn't help himself. He laughed. So it's a dumb idea, said Olyado. You see better than anyone else I know, said Ender. I've got to think about this, but you might be right. They drove on in silence for a while. I was just talking, said Olyado. When I said that about Miro, it was just something I thought, putting him together with that old story. It probably isn't even a true story. It's true, said Ender. How do you know? I knew Mazer Rackham. Olyado whistled. Whew! You're old. You're older than any of the trees. I'm older than any of the human colonies. It doesn't make me wise, unfortunately. Are you really Ender, the Ender? That's why it's my password. It's funny. Before you got here, the bishop tried to tell us all that you were Satan. King's the only one in the family that took him seriously. But if the bishop had told us you were Ender, we would have stoned you to death in the Praza that day you arrived. Why don't you now? We know you now. That makes all the difference, doesn't it? Even King doesn't hate you now. When you really know somebody, you can't hate them. Or maybe it's just that you can't really know them until you stop hating them. Is that a circular paradox? Don Cristão says that most truth can only be expressed in circular paradoxes. I don't think it has anything to do with truth, Oliado. It's just cause and effect. We never can sort them out. Science refuses to admit any cause except first cause. Knock down one domino, the one next to it also falls. But when it comes to human beings, the only type of cause that matters is final cause, the purpose, what a person had in mind. Once you understand what people really want, you can't hate them anymore. You can fear them, but you can't hate them, because you can always find the same desires in your own heart. Mother doesn't like it that you're Ender, I know. But she loves you anyway, I know. And King, it's really funny, but now that he knows you're Ender, he likes you better for it. That's because he's a crusader, and I got my bad reputation by winning a crusade. And me, said Oliado. Yes, you, said Ender. You killed more people than anybody in history. Be the best at whatever you do, that's what my mother always told me. But when you spoke for Father, you made me feel sorry for him. You make people love each other and forgive each other. How could you kill all those millions of people in the Xenocide? I thought I was playing games. I didn't know it was the real thing. But that's no excuse, Oliado. If I had known the battle was real, I would have done the same thing. We thought they wanted to kill us. We were wrong, but we had no way to know that. Ender shook his head. Except that I knew better. I knew my enemy. That's how I beat her, the Hive Queen. I knew her so well that I loved her. Or maybe I loved her so well that I knew her. I didn't want to fight her anymore. I wanted to quit. I wanted to go home. So I blew up her planet. And today we found a place to bring her back to life. Oliado was very serious. Are you sure she won't try to get even? Are you sure she won't try to wipe out humankind starting with you? I'm as sure, said Ender, as I am of anything. Not absolutely sure, said Oliado. Sure enough to bring her back to life, said Ender. And that's as sure as we ever are of anything. We believe it enough to act as though it's true. When we're that sure, we call it knowledge. Facts. We bet our lives on it. I guess that's what you're doing, betting your life on her being what you think she is. Oh, I'm more arrogant than that. I'm betting your life, too, and everybody else's. And I'm not so much as asking anyone else's opinion. Funny, said Oliado. If I asked somebody whether they trust Ender with a decision that might affect the future of the human race, they'd say, of course not. But if I asked them whether they trust the speaker for the dead, they'd say, yes, most of them. And they wouldn't even guess that they were the same person. Yeah, said Ender. Funny. Neither of them laughed. Then, after a long time, Oliado spoke again. His thoughts had wandered to a subject that mattered more. I don't want Miro to go away for 30 years. You will be 42. And he'll come back the age he is now, 20, half my age. If there's ever a girl who wants to marry a guy with reflecting eyes, I might even be married and have kids then. He won't even know me. I won't be his little brother anymore. Oliado swallowed. It'd be like him dying. No, said Ender. It'd be like him passing from his second life to his third. That's like dying too, said Oliado. It's also like being born, said Ender. As long as you keep getting born, it's all right to die sometimes. Valentine called the next day. Ender's fingers trembled as he keyed instructions into the terminal. It wasn't just a message, either. It was a call, a full, answerable voice communication. Incredibly expensive, but that wasn't the problem. It was the fact that answerable communications with 100 worlds were supposedly cut off. For Jane to allow this call to come through meant that it was urgent. It occurred to Ender right away that Valentine might be in danger, that Starways Congress might have decided Ender was involved in the rebellion and traced his connection with her. She was older, The hologram of her face showed weather lines from many windy days on the islands, floes, and boats of Trondheim. But her smile was the same, and her eyes danced with the same light. Ender was silenced at first by the changes the years had wrought in his sister. She, too, was silenced by the fact that Ender seemed unchanged, a vision coming back to her out of the past.
Ah, Ender, was I ever so young?
And will I age so beautifully? She laughed, then she cried. He did not, how could he? He had missed her for a couple of months. She had missed him for 22 years. I suppose you've heard about our trouble getting along with Congress.
I imagine that you were at the thick of it.
Stumbled into the situation, really, but I'm glad I was here. I'm going to stay.
She nodded, drying her eyes. Yes, I thought so. But I had to call and make sure. I didn't want to spend a couple of decades flying to meet you and have you gone when I arrive.
Meet me?
I got much too excited about your revolution there, Ender. After 20 years of raising a family, teaching my students, loving my husband, living at peace with myself, I thought I'd never resurrect Demosthenes again. But then the story came about illegal contact with the Piggies, and right away the news that Lusitania was in revolt. And suddenly people were saying the most ridiculous things, and I saw it was the beginning of the same old hate. Remember the videos about the buggers? How terrifying and awful they were. Suddenly we were seeing videos of the bodies they found, of the xenologists. I can't remember their names, but grisly pictures everywhere you looked, heating us up to war fever. And then stories about the Discolada, how if anyone ever went from Lusitania to another world, it would destroy everything. The most hideous plague imaginable.
It's true, but we're working on it, trying to find ways to keep the Descolada from spreading when we go to other worlds.
True or not, Ender, it's all leading to war. I remember war. Nobody else does. So I revived Demosthenes. I stumbled across some memos and reports. Their fleet is carrying the little doctor, Ender. If they decide to, they can blow Lusitania to bits. Just like...
Just like I did before. Poetic justice, do you think, for me to end the same way? He who lives by the sword.
Don't joke with me, Ender. I'm a middle-aged matron now, and I've lost my patience with silliness. At least for now. I wrote some very ugly truths about what Starway's Congress is doing and published them as Demosthenes. They're looking for me. Treason is what they're calling it.
So you're coming here?
Not just me. Dear Yacht is turning the fleet over to his brothers and sisters. We've already bought a starship. There's apparently some kind of resistance movement that's helping us. Someone named Jane has jimmied the computers to cover our tracks.
I know Jane.
So you do have an organization here. I was shocked when I got a message that I could call you. Your Ansible was supposedly blown up.
We have powerful friends.
Ender, Yacht and I are leaving today. We're bringing our 3 children.
Your first one?
Yes, Sifta. The one who was making me fat when you left. She's almost 22 now. A very lovely girl. And a good friend, the children's tutor named Plikt.
Well, I have a student by that name, said Ender, thinking back to conversations only a couple of months ago.
Oh, yes, well, that was 22 years ago, Ender. It's not an emergency. You have 22 years to prepare for me. Well, actually longer, more like 30 years. We're taking the voyage in several hops, the first few in the wrong direction so that nobody can be sure we're going to Lusitania.
Coming here, 30 years from now. I'll be older than she is now. Coming here. By then I'll have my family, too. Novinia's and my children, if we have any, all grown like hers. And then, thinking of Novinia, he remembered Miro. Remembered what Olliato had suggested several days ago, the day they found the nesting place for the Hive Queen. Would you mind, terribly, if I sent someone to meet you on the way?
Meet us? In deep space? No, don't send someone to do that, Ender. It's too terrible a sacrifice to come so far when the computers can guide us in just fine.
It's not really for you, though I want him to meet you. He's one of the Xenologers. He was badly injured in an accident, some brain damage, like a bad stroke. He's the smartest person in Lusitania, says someone whose judgment I trust. But he's lost all his connections with our life here. Yet we'll need him later, when you arrive. He's a very good man, Val. He can make the last week of your voyage very educational.
Can your friend arrange to get us course information for such a rendezvous? Oh, we're navigators, but only on the sea.
Jane will have the revised navigational information in your ship's computer when you leave.
Ender, for you it'll be 30 years, but for me, I'll see you in only a few weeks.
Maybe I'll come with Miro to meet you.
Don't! I want you to be as old and crabbed as possible when I arrive. I couldn't put up with you as the 30-year-old brat I see on my terminal.
35.
You'll be there when I arrive, she demanded.
I will. And Miro, the boy I'm sending to you, think of him as my son.
She nodded gravely. These are such dangerous times, Ender. I only wish we had Peter.
I don't. If he were running our little rebellion, he'd end up hegemon of all the 100 worlds. We just want them to leave us alone.
It may not be possible to get the one without the other. But we can quarrel about that later. Goodbye, my dear brother.
He didn't answer. Just looked at her and looked at her until she smiled wryly and switched off the connection. Ender didn't have to ask Miro to go. Jane had already told him everything.
Your sister is Demosthenes?
Asked Miro. Ender was used to his slurred speech now, or maybe his speech was clearing a little. It wasn't as hard to understand anyway. We were a talented family, said Ender. I hope you like her.
I hope she likes me.
Miro smiled, but he looked afraid. I told her, said Ender, to think of you as my son. Miro nodded.
I know, he said.
And then, almost defiantly, she showed me your conversation with her. Ender felt cold inside. Jane's voice came into his ear.
I should have asked you, she said. But you know you would have said yes.
It wasn't the invasion of privacy that Ender minded. It was the fact that Jane was so very close to Miro. Get used to it, he told himself. He's the one she's looking out for now. We'll miss you, said Ender.
Those who will miss me already, said Miro, because they already think of me as dead.
We need you alive, said Ender. When I come back, I'll still be only 19 and brain damaged. You'll still be Miro, and brilliant, and trusted, and loved. You started this rebellion, Miro. The fence came down for you. Not for some great cause, but for you. Don't let us down. Miro smiled, but Ender couldn't tell if the twist in his smile was because of his paralysis or because it was a bitter, poisonous smile. Tell me something, said Miro. If I won't, said Ender, she will. It isn't hard. I just want to know what it was that Pippo and Libo died for. What it was the piggies honored them for. Ender understood better than Miro knew. He understood why the boy cared so much about the question. Miro had learned that he was really Libo's son only hours before he crossed the fence and lost his future. Pippo, then Libo, then Miro, father, son, grandson. The three Xenologers who had lost their futures for the piggy's sake. Miro hoped that in understanding why his forebears died, he might make more sense of his own sacrifice. The trouble was that the truth might well leave Miro feeling that none of the sacrifices meant anything at all. So Ender answered with a question. Don't you already know why? Miro spoke slowly and carefully so that Ender could understand his slurred speech. I know that the piggies thought they were doing them an honor. I know that Manda Chuva and Leaf Eater could have died in their places. With Libo, I even know the occasion. It was when the first amaranth harvest came. and there was plenty of food. They were rewarding him for that. Except why not earlier? Why not when we taught them to use Merdona root? Why not when we taught them to make pots or shoot arrows? The truth, said Ender. Miro knew from Ender's tone that the truth would not be easy. Yes, he said. Neither Pipo nor Lebo really deserved the honor. It wasn't the amaranth the wives were rewarding. It was the fact that Leaf Eater had persuaded them to let a whole generation of infants be conceived and born, even though there wasn't enough food for them to eat once they left the mother tree. It was a terrible risk to take, and if he had been wrong, that whole generation of piggies would have died. Lebo brought the harvest, but Leaf Eater was the one who had, in a sense, brought the population to a point where they needed the grain. Miro nodded. Pipo? Pipo told the piggies about his discovery, that the Descolada, which killed humans, was part of their normal physiology, that their bodies could handle transformations that killed us. Mandachuva told the wives that this meant that humans were not godlike and all-powerful, that in some ways we were even weaker than the little ones, that what made humans stronger than piggies was not something inherent in us, our size, our brains, our language, but rather the mere accident that we were a few thousand years ahead of them in learning. If they could acquire our knowledge, then we humans would have no more power over them. Mandachuva's discovery that piggies were potentially equal to humans, that was what they rewarded, not the information people gave that led to that discovery. So both of them, the piggies, didn't want to kill either people or Lebo. In both cases, the crucial achievement belonged to a Pequenino. The only reason Pipo and Lebo died was because they couldn't bring themselves to take a knife and kill a friend. Miro must have seen the pain in Ender's face, despite his best effort to conceal it, because it was Ender's bitterness that he answered. You, said Miro, you can kill anybody. It's a knack I was born with, said Ender. You killed human because you knew it would make him live a new and better life, said Miro. Yes. And me, said Miro. Yes, said Ender. Sending you away is very much like killing you. But will I live a new and better life? I don't know. Already you get around better than a tree. Miro laughed. So I've got one thing on old human, don't I? At least I'm ambulatory. And nobody has to hit me with a stick so I can talk. Then Miro's expression grew sour again. Of course, now he can have 1,000 children. Don't count on being celibate all your life, said Ender. You may be disappointed. I hope so, said Miro. And then, after a silence, Speaker, call me Ender. Ender, did Pipo and Lebo die for nothing then? Ender understood the real question. Am I also enduring this for nothing? There are worse reasons to die, Ender answered, than to die because you cannot bear to kill. What about someone, said Miro, who can't kill and can't die and can't live either? Don't deceive yourself, said Ender. You will do all three someday. Miro left the next morning. There were tearful goodbyes. For weeks afterward, it was hard for Novinia to spend any time in her own house because Miro's absence was so painful to her. Even though she had agreed wholeheartedly with Ender that it was right for Miro to go, it was still unbearable to lose her child. It made Ender wonder if his own parents felt such pain when he was taken away. He suspected they had not, nor had they hoped for his return. He already loved another man's children more than his parents had loved their own child. Well, he'd get fit revenge for their neglect of him. He'd show them, 3,000 years later, how a father should behave. Bishop Peregrino married them in his chambers. Before the marriage, though, there were 2 days of note. On a day in summer, Ella, Wanda, and Novinia presented him with the results of their research and speculation. As completely as possible, the life cycle and community structure of the piggies, male and female, and the likely reconstruction of their patterns of life before the Descolada bonded them forever to the trees that, till then, had been no more to them than habitat. Ender had reached his own understanding of who the Pecaninos were, and especially who human was before his passage to the life of light. He lived with the piggies for a week while he wrote The Life of Human. Mandachuva and Leaf Eater read it carefully, discussed it with him. He revised and reshaped. Finally, it was ready. On that day, he invited everyone who was working with the piggies, all the Hibera family, Wanda and her sisters, the many workmen who had brought technological miracles to the piggies, the scholar monks of the Children of the Mind, Bishop Peregrino, Mayor Bosquinha, and read the book to them. It wasn't long, less than an hour to read. They had gathered on the hillside near where Human's seedling tree reached upward, now more than 3 meters high, and where Reuter overshadowed them in the afternoon sunlight. "Speaker," said the bishop, "almost thou persuadest me to become a humanist." Others, less trained to eloquence, found no words to say, not then or ever. But they knew from that day forward who the piggies were, just as the readers of the Hive Queen had understood the buggers, and the readers of the Hegemon had understood humankind in its endless quest for greatness in a wilderness of separation and suspicion. "This was why I called you here," said Novinia. "I dreamed once of writing this book, but you had to write it." "I played more of a role in the story than I would have chosen for myself," said Ender. "But you fulfilled your dream, Ivanova. It was your work that led to this book, and you and your children who made me whole enough to write it." He signed it, as he had signed the others, the speaker for the dead. Jane took the book and carried it by Ansible across the light years to the 100 worlds. With it she brought the text of the covenant and Olyado's pictures of its signing and of the passage of human into the full light. She placed it here and there in a score of places on each of the 100 worlds, giving it to people likely to read it and understand what it was. Copies were sent as messages from computer to computer. By the time the Starways Congress knew of it, it was too widely distributed to be suppressed. Instead, they tried to discredit it as a fake. The pictures were a crude simulation. Textual analysis revealed that it could not possibly have the same author as the other two books. Ansible usage records revealed that it could not possibly have come from Lusitania, which had no Ansible. Some people believed them. Most people didn't care. Many who did care enough to read The Life of Human hadn't the heart to accept the piggies as Raman. Some did accept the piggies, and read the accusation that Demosthenes had written a few months before, and began to call the fleet that was already underway toward Lusitania the Second Xenocide. It was a very ugly name. There weren't enough jails in the 100 worlds to hold all those who used it. The Starways Congress had thought the war would begin when their ships reached Lusitania 30 or 40 years from then. Instead, the war was already begun, and it would be fierce. What the speaker for the dead wrote, many people believed, and many were ready to accept the piggies as Raman, and to think of anyone who sought their deaths as murderers. Then, on a day in autumn, Ender took the carefully wrapped cocoon, and he and Novinia, Olyado, Keen, and Ella skimmed over the kilometers of Capim till they came to the hill beside the river. The daisies they had planted were in furious bloom. The winter here would be mild, and the Hive Queen would be safe from the Descolada. Ender carried the Hive Queen gingerly to the river bank and laid her in the chamber he and Olyado had prepared. They laid the carcass of a freshly killed cabra on the ground outside her chamber, and then Olyado drove them back. Ender wept with the vast, uncontrollable ecstasy that the Hive Queen placed within his mind, her rejoicing too strong for a human heart to bear. Novinia held him. King quietly prayed, and Ella sang a jaunty folk song that once had been heard in the hill country of Minas Gerais, among the Caipiras and Mineiros of old Brazil. It was a good time, a good place to be. Better than Ender had ever dreamed for himself in the sterile corridors of the battle school when he was little and fighting for his life. "I can probably die now," said Ender. "All my life's work is done." "Mine too," said Novinia, "but I think that means that it's time to start to live." Behind them, in the dank and humid air of a shallow cave by a river, strong mandibles tore at the cocoon, and a limp and skeletal body struggled forth, her wings only gradually spread out and dried in the sunlight. She struggled weakly to the riverbank and pulled strength and moisture into her desiccated body. She nibbled at the meat of the cabra. The unhatched eggs she held within her cried out to be released. She laid the first dozen of them in the cabra's corpse, then ate the nearest daisies, trying to feel the changes in her body as she came alive at last. The sunlight on her back, the breeze against her wings, the water cool under her feet, her eggs warming and maturing in the flesh of the cabra. Life so long waited for, and not until today could she be sure that she would be not the last of her tribe, but the first.
It's kind of funny, considering that Speaker for the Dead was the book I really intended to write, and Ender's Game was just the intro, really, to Speaker for the Dead, that it's Ender's Game that has become my most read, most translated, most popular work. Speaker for the Dead is still, in some ways, the deeper story to me, and the one that talks about issues that I think have more of an effect on the real world. In working on Speaker for the Dead, it had a strange kind of origin. I first conceived of it as, the original title, in fact, was Singer of Death. But my wife said, look, you just wrote Songmaster and Unaccompanied Sonata. That's really quite enough stories about musicians for one career. She's right. I haven't really done much then with musicians since then. And I changed it to what I am, which is a storyteller. But in a way, that really made me nervous. I've done a lot of sneering at the formula of literary fiction, because it always has a writer, a storyteller, an artist of some kind, a musician or whatever, at the core of the story, somebody who represents the author's wishes for what he is and shows that he has a special sensitivity and a deeper feeling about things and is just better than average people. And I don't believe that. You know, writers are regular people. We are not special. We don't see anything better. We just say things about it better. So I resisted that kind of story as much as I could. When I caught myself doing it, as with the music stories, I stopped. But with Speaker for the Dead, the origin was something more important than the sensitive artist. The origin was, what do we do about dead people whose lives were really crummy? What do we do about people who were vicious? You've all seen or can imagine at least that kind of funeral where this is a person who poisoned everything he touched. Everybody around him was miserable because he was alive. What do you say at the funeral? You know, you can, if you're Christian, you can talk about the hope of a glorious resurrection. You can preach forgiveness. But by and large, what we do at people's funerals is we lie. I remember being in Brazil. I was a missionary there. And I attended the funeral of a woman who was desquitada from her husband, not divorced, but separated, which is like divorce, only you can't remarry, very painful. But he had kept a mistress throughout that time. And so I had talked to her several times while he was still alive about how miserable she was and what an awful person he had been to her and all kinds of things like that. And so there we were at the funeral. There was his coffin in the middle of the church meeting house. And every few minutes she would do, as was the custom in Brazil, stand up, walk over to the coffin and weep and wail over the coffin. And here's what she said. She said, "You were a wonderful husband. You were a good man. You made my life bright and wonderful. Everything you did was good. You were such a good man. The world is poorer because you're gone." And I could hardly stand to hear this because every word about it was a lie. And I thought, how can she do that when she was so unhappy because of him? And then I realized it was because she was now erasing him. The life he actually lived was over. He was gone. He couldn't do anything to contradict her. Now she could make him over into the husband he should have been. And I thought, in a way, this is her vengeance. She can eradicate the man he actually was and create in his place the man that she wished she had married. And that's really quite a cruel thing to do. It was her vengeance, and it was a perfect vengeance. After all he had done to her, she got to wipe him out now. Well, what I wanted to explore was the opposite approach to death, which was to face what the person actually was, to face their life when it's finally over and you can kind of start assigning meanings to it. And so I invented the idea of a speaker for the dead, somebody who gets up and tells their story, but not as they would want it told, certainly not presenting the image that they would have liked to present, but instead presenting what they actually were. And what I realized was that if you really understand someone well enough to speak for them when they're dead, you will end up probably loving them. Now, that's a pretty bold thing to say, because what if you had to speak for the death of Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin or somebody like that? But I really think that if you knew enough about them, you could at least understand how they got set on the road that led to the terrible things they did. And you don't pull any punches. You name their sins for what they were. You talk about their flaws. You talk about their horrible choices, the viciousness, the vileness, whatever they did. But you also say, but at one point, this was a child. At one point, this was a kid who wept, or a kid who wanted to be loved, or a kid who tried to do well at this or at that. You look at the war experiences that shaped Adolf Hitler, or you look at the deep hunger for influence and control that drove Joseph Stalin in his childhood. And it doesn't excuse anything, but it makes the person comprehensible. You're doing the opposite of the kind of vengeance she was taking. You don't eradicate them. You don't glorify them either. You just face them for what they were, good and bad. You understand how it is that a human being could get to where they are. And that's the goal that I was trying for in Speaker for the Dead. Not to show Ender as a deeply sensitive person, though in fact I think he would be a deeply sensitive person, and he'd be able to deal with this problem-ridden family and to love them. And so that's important to me, that he had that response. But you notice when he walks into the family, he doesn't walk in as some goody-two-shoes saying, I'm going to come and make you happy. He comes in and faces Grego as an antisocial monster and won't take it from him, won't put up with it. He gives him the discipline that shows that somebody actually cares enough about his life to try to change him, to try to stop him from being a monster. He tries to win the others over not by sucking up to them, but by being himself as honestly as he can be and responding to them as one human being to another. And when it comes time for the speaking for the dead, what he is not a saint, not a sinner, simply an honest man. That's what I think all of us would like at some point in our lives, is to be seen truly and wholly for what we are. I could face the criticism if the person could also see the good things in my life. Likewise, I wouldn't feel guilty about somebody praising me for the good things if I knew that I was receiving that praise from somebody who also knew the bad. And so that's what Speaker for the Dead is about. And I think that that's really more important than anything in Ender's Game. So to me, this is still the book, the real book. And even though I'm very happy with Ender's Game, I love the kids in Ender's Game. I care about them. I think that they matter. It's not that the book is trivial. It's that it exists so that I could tell the story of Speaker for the Dead.
Speaker for the Dead by Orson Scott Card is an unabridged production of Fantastic Audio, an imprint of Audio Literature. Read by David Burney, Scott Brick, Gabrielle DeCure, Amanda Carr, Lisa Nemacek, John Rubenstein, Stefan Rudnicki, and Don Schlossman. Produced by Stefan Rudnicki. Directed by Stefan Rudnicki and Gabrielle DeCure. Recorded at the Audio Literature Studio, Studio City, California. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Ted Scott. Copyright 2002, American Audio Literature.